You're listening to Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG online. We're at kpcg.fm. Live link at thetrumpet.com as well. It's Trumpet Radio Live, our weekend edition. Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon with you here today, getting into the weekend. This is an exciting weekend that's coming up in a couple of weeks because the Olympics, the Summer Olympics, are getting started. And a lot of the websites, they have the medal count graphic. And, of course, it hasn't started yet, so everybody's at zeros. Everybody's equal, but that shall soon change.
Everyone has a chance.
Everyone wants to get a medal, of course. Athletes are showing up there at the Olympic Village, and CNN.com says, Rio 2016 Athletes Village, a salon, a florist, even a McDonald's.
Mm.
And which surprised me that there's a McDonald's in the Athletes Village, because these are supposed to be the best athletes in the world. I was wondering, you know, has an athlete ever got up to the start of their event, you know, and thought, I've worked my whole life for this, and then thought, I shouldn't have eaten that McDonald's. I shouldn't have had that this morning.
LeBron James actually endorses McDonald's, but he's not on the men's basketball team, and they're not even staying in the Olympic Village. They're on a yacht. So, I mean, who is this really for?
Yeah, I want to know more about this yacht that they're staying on. But
I don't know if I do.
Yeah, maybe I don't. Sometimes it is an interesting situation because you have athletes, of course, that are, I guess you consider them amateurs, or they don't get maybe paid as much for what they're doing. And then you have some athletes that are multimillionaires, such as the NBA players. So all kinds of different people there, different walks of life, and interesting experience. We've got some interesting details about the Summer Olympics we'll talk about later. And also we'll talk about a few other headlines, as well as the Key of David program and the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. All kinds of good things to talk about today. But we're going to start, keeping with this Olympic, this Summer Olympic theme, we're going to start with an Olympic quiz. We have not taken this. This is going to be live. And
I don't know what it is.
It's from CNN.com. This is an Olympic quiz that they have, and to see how much we know. So we'll take our best guesses here. Which of the following has never been an Olympic event? Hot air ballooning, croquet, 10-pin bowling, or motorcycle racing?
10-pin bowling?
10-pin bowling, okay. My first thought was hot air ballooning, but we'll see. Ah, you're right.
Oh, man.
10-pin bowling.
Yes.
10-pin bowling has never been named as an official Olympic sport, though it is one of the 8 shortlisted sports for 2020 Tokyo Games. They're thinking about getting into that. Ballooning, motorcycle racing, and croquet have all been bona fide events. So, strange. I could see, I just can't see hot air ballooning being an event. But
I thought that one might be the trick answer, so I didn't choose it.
Yeah. Next question is, which sport is returning to the Olympics at Rio after a 112-year absence? Tug of war, conkers, I don't even know what that is.
What?
Golf, or sumo wrestling?
Oh. Conkers.
I'll say conkers too, because I don't know what that means. We'll find out. No, it's golf.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to look up conkers later. I don't know what that is. Maybe it's something they made up. They say golf's last Olympic appearance was at St. Louis in 1904.
Oh.
However, many of its leading men have pulled out of Rio 2016, which happens sometimes where the pros have other things to do. Rugby is also set to return in Brazil, as the sevens format makes its debut after a 15 aside last featured in 1924. So golf is making a return. I guess I just hadn't thought much about that, but yeah, they haven't had golf.
Yeah, I heard about that recently and just, I guess, forgot about it. Now that you mention it.
You were distracted by conkers.
Yeah, that threw me off. That was the trick answer in that one.
Next question is, what unusual record does London 2012 Olympian Ricardo Blas Jr. hold? Heaviest competitor in the history of modern Olympics, smallest competitor, tallest competitor, or lightest competitor? I don't know who that is, so I have no idea.
Smallest.
Okay, we'll go with smallest. No, he was the heaviest competitor.
What? Oh.
He tipped the scales at 218 kilograms, more than twice the 100-kilogram cutoff point for judo's biggest weight category. He's known as the Little Mountain. Hey, who am I fighting today? Oh, some guy named the Little Mountain.
So he was a judo athlete?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's unless your name is the Big Mountain, that's going to be a tough day for you.
Yeah.
So, they come in all shapes and sizes. Next question, what is the Olympic motto? You miss 100% of the shots you don't take. Man's reach exceeds his grasp. I'm loving it. That's McDonald's logo.
Come on.
Or this other one, which I probably will not pronounce correctly, Sidious Altius Fortius.
That one.
Probably that one. It sounds official. That's correct.
Yes.
Yeah. It's Latin. It means faster, higher, stronger.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I'm loving it.
Maybe they just adopted the McDonald's theme after it's been put in the Olympic Village.
Hey, no golden medals, but you go to the Golden Arches. We're all champions. Next question is, of the following four nations, only one has an Olympic medal to its name, which? Bolivia, Djibouti, Albania, or Fiji?
I'm going to have to go with Bolivia.
We'll try Bolivia and see. No, it's Djibouti.
Wow.
The small African nation has a single bronze won by marathon runner Ahmed Salah at the 1988 Seoul Olympics. So, yeah, they only have one. If you're going to have one, you'd hope it would be a gold, but it happens. It's hard for some of these smaller nations. You have a smaller... It's like being in a smaller school and playing the big school down the road.
Right.
You're like, where did these kids come from? They're twice our size.
Just simply a larger talent pool to select from.
Yeah.
That's why the U.S. always does so well.
That's right. In some countries, it seems like in races, they're running for their lives. Other, and we're just running for, you know, sport.
Yeah. Maybe that would help them then.
Maybe so. I always thought some of the long-distance runners that are really good from those African nations, and they always run barefoot. I always think, maybe they run from lions.
Probably.
Like they've got a real reason to get going.
Serious sense of urgency.
Yeah. At the next question, at the 1900 Paris Olympics, women were not allowed to compete. Everyone competed naked. I don't think that's true. There were more athletes than spectators. Men fought bears. Which one?
What was the first one? Women were not allowed to compete.
Women were not allowed to compete.
I'll do that one.
Okay, we'll try that one. There were more athletes than spectators.
Second choice.
There really were more athletes than spectators. They said the croquet was a particular hit with just a single paying spectator. He came all the way from Nice.
Wow.
The one fan. Wow. Yeah, interesting. Next question. What percentage of an Olympic gold medal is actually gold? 76 to 100%, 26 to 50, 51 to 75, or 0 to 25?
0 to 25.
Correct. Far less than most would think. It says, indeed, the medals at the London 2012 Games were just 1.34% gold. The medals are required to be made of at least 92.5 silver, and though they must contain a minimum of 6 grams of gold, there's actually more copper in it than gold. So it's interesting. I don't know. I guess I just kind of stupidly thought they're made out of solid gold, but they're not.
That would be costly.
Yeah.
And people couldn't tell visually much of a difference.
Yeah, probably so. You know, a couple years back, you remember when they did the glass medals and they just put like the kind of a little bit of a gold dusting on it? I don't think those were very popular.
No.
I don't know why they did those. What is the slowest official 100 meters time at a World Championships or Olympic Games? 11 seconds, 15.66 seconds, 12.15 seconds, or 10 minutes?
10 minutes. The 12-second one.
Okay. 15.66 seconds.
Wow. I could beat that.
The guy that ran it, he has a really different name. Sogolo Tuvalu. He was a shot putter by trade. And at the 2011 World's Championship, his odds were 50,000 to 1. He was, and though the 17-year-old American Samoan came in nearly 5 seconds behind the eventual winner of his heat, it's a taking part that counts. Indeed, he got a personal best on the day despite being the only man in the field not wearing spikes. That's
wow.
Pretty bad when it's 100 meters and it's 5 seconds after the winner that you come in. Usually it's half a second, and even that seems like quite
right.
A bit.
Yeah, exactly. I guess that's not his original sport.
No.
maybe blew out a hammy. partway through.
Who knows? Yeah, he was not prepared, apparently. Which three continents have never held an Olympic Games? Antarctica, Asia, Europe, Africa, South America, Antarctica, North America, Antarctica, Australasia, Australasia, Africa, Asia. If you can remember all of those.
What was the second one?
Africa, South America, Antarctica.
Yeah.
Correct. Rio de Janeiro will be the first South American city to host the Olympics. Africa and perhaps, understandably, Antarctica also. That would be kind of interesting, yeah. Though. The great Antarctica Summer Olympics.
Yeah, make sure it's during the summer at least.
Yeah. This one, next question. In direct competition, which of the following would win a flat-out 100-meter sprint? An elephant, an ostrich, Usain Bolt, or a cheetah?
Oh, wow. 100 meters. I'll say an ostrich.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing, just because it seems unlikely, but... Oh, no, it's a cheetah. The cheetah can cover 100 meters in under 6 seconds.
Wow.
Nearly 60% faster than Bolt, whose 9.58 time is the fastest by a human. He would never win the Animal Olympics. He's not fast enough.
I think there was something I read, like the cheetah takes a little bit of time to get up to that top speed.
Yeah.
So if it was a short enough run, someone like Usain Bolt probably could win.
Right.
But that is not the distance, apparently.
Right. How many different events will there be at Rio 2016? 306, 122, 400, or 55?
102, is that?
122?
122.
306.
What?
Yeah, water polo to weightlifting, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Unbelievable.
That's a lot of events. Which member of the British royal family has won an Olympic medal? Queen Elizabeth II for hurdles, Prince George for discus, Zara Phillips for equestrian, Alfred the Great, 1,500 meter.
Alfred the Great.
Okay, we'll try that. Yep, it's Zara Phillips.
What?
Equestrian. I don't know who that is.
I don't either.
But her mother was Princess Anne.
Okay.
And I thought it might be that because you could see them doing a lot with horses and being involved in mm-hmm. that. So, yeah. So she won.
I guess that makes sense.
Yeah, won a medal there. Why is the marathon 26 miles and 385 yards long? Because... A British queen demanded that the race end directly beneath her royal box. It relates to the distance between Athens and the Greek city of Olympia. According to ancient scripture, the Greek god Atlas was said to be exactly that tall. The first Olympic course organizer stopped for a beer and lost count. Now they're just getting ridiculous.
It's the distance between Athens and Olympia?
No. Wow, I'm surprised by this. It's because a British queen demanded that the race end directly beneath the royal box. This is what they claim. They say legends tell that Philippides, whatever his name is, ran from the Greek city of Marathon all the way to Athens in order to deliver news of the ancient story in their battle against the Persians, thereby inspiring the long-distance race. However, the current distance wasn't standardized until 1908 London Olympics when Queen Alexandra of Great Britain rather whimsically decreed that the race should finish below the royal box. That added 385 yards to the distance.
Oh, I see.
So, but they make it out like it wasn't a demand. She just said, hey, it'd be neat if we did it this way. So,
yeah.
Yeah, that's a trick question.
That's why they added the extra yards. It sounded a little bit suspicious.
Yeah. A couple more here. Women were allowed to compete for the first time in 1900. What did the winners receive that year instead of gold medals? Paintings, porcelain figurines, livestock, or wreaths?
Wreaths? What is that?
Like the flowers?
Oh, okay. Yeah.
It's actually they got paintings.
Wow.
Wreaths are an ancient Olympic tradition, which of course is why we probably thought of that.
Yeah.
Female athletes in the 1900 Paris Games did indeed receive valuable paintings and works of art rather than gold medals. And those are probably worth more today. Than the medals would be. Got to hang it around your neck, though. It's a little awkward.
I wonder if that's how they did it. Put a ribbon around the painting and then put that around your neck.
Giant painting, yeah. During the 1928 Amsterdam Olympics, what did rower Henry Bobby Pierce have to wait for in the middle of his race? Was it the elevation of a canal bridge, a replacement oar, the removal of a streaker, a family of ducks?
A family of ducks.
Correct.
Oh, yes.
And he still won the gold. Way to go. That's quite remarkable. The Rio 2016 Games will be the first to feature samba as an Olympic discipline, feature Barcelona star Neymar, feature Olympians born in this millennium, feature a 300-meter sprint.
300-meter sprint?
Feature Olympians born in this millennium.
What?
Yeah. That's pretty amazing.
Already?
Yeah, already. August Olympics will be the first to feature competitors born this side of the year 2000. And so it's pretty amazing how time passes
by. Is there no age minimum? They were going to be 16 years old.
There is, let's see. They say Togolese swimmer Kaposi came close in the 2012 games. She was 13 when she competed, but she was, you know, obviously last century. So, yeah, pretty interesting. Two more here. How did American Robert Lee Gendre come to smash the long jump world record in 1924 but still end up with a bronze? His record-breaking jump was ruled out. He was competing in another event. Two others went on to break the record. He was competing against horses.
His longest jump was ruled out.
He was competing in another event.
Huh.
Oh, that's interesting. So he jumped that far, but it wasn't in that actual event. It was in something else.
Oh, that's strange.
Yeah. That's really strange.
Still count it.
Yeah, that is really strange. I've never heard of that.
Yeah.
Last one. Why were all equestrian events at the 1956 Melbourne Games held 9,700 miles away in Stockholm? There were not enough specialist airplanes to fly the horses over. The king of Sweden at the time, Gustav VI, was a keen rider himself. It's a universally acknowledged truth that Sweden has the most majestic steeds. Australia's quarantine rule made it impractical to transport horses.
Yeah, the quarantine rule.
Okay. Correct. Yeah. Yes, Australian authorities refused to change the country's strict rules for importing animals, which required a six-month quarantine, so all equestrian events at the 1956 Olympics were instead held in Sweden.
Mm.
So pretty interesting, just some of those. I don't think we did very well in that quiz.
Does it give our results?
I wasn't keeping score.
Okay. We were probably about 40%, something like that.
Somewhere in there, yeah. So that is always interesting. There's always a lot of different things that have happened over the years in Olympics, that some stories that are very famous and others that are not quite as well known, like the guy waiting for the ducks.
And that, the fact that there's 306 events, was that what it was?
Yeah, over 300.
Wow.
And then what was that, in the 19, well, whatever that was, that one early Olympics, there was only one paying spectator for croquet.
In France.
Yeah. So not as popular of a sport, I guess. So that's kind of interesting in relation to the Olympics. Here's an interesting headline today. This is shifting gears here a little bit. This is from the Washington Post. And a lot of times we talk about the Bible and archaeology. And sometimes they find things, and they find things that do kind of prove the Bible in a way, even though they're not looking at it like that. It says, legends say China began in a great flood. Scientists just found evidence that that flood was real. So they go through quite a bit of the evidence and how they figured it out. But scientists think this flood happened around 4,000 years ago.
Hmm.
They say the flood, this is what they write up in their history anyway. They say the flood is pouring forth destruction, boundless and overwhelming. It overtops hills and mountains, rising and ever rising. It threatens the very heavens.
Sounds familiar.
It does. It sounds a little bit like the Bible, doesn't it?
It does. And people always scoff at that, but archaeology proves it true so many times.
It says there's a new paper. It was published just on Thursday in the journal Science. A man by the name of Wu and his colleagues describe geological evidence for a catastrophic flood on the Yellow River in about 1900 BC, right around the time of the Great Flood that they talk about, was said to have taken place. And you can read more about that at the Washington Post. But basically, in looking at the river, they saw some deposits that shouldn't be from that area. They should have been from up in the mountains. And they thought, well, how did that get down here? And they did some investigation and tried to determine what happened. And they said, well, there actually was this huge flood, and it was just about 4,000 years ago. And so it's interesting when you read the comments. Yeah, people bring it up. They say, well, what about Noah? And then people jump on that and say, that's ridiculous. And back and forth, they have their arguments about it. But the science is proving that there was a really large flood, and it was just about 4,000 years ago, give or take. And there's a lot, even in let's say the ancient history of different nations, a lot of them point back to some sort of a catastrophic flood.
Right. And a lot of the time what happens is experts say that those accounts are exaggerated. So they say really a flood that eclipses the mountaintops, how could that ever be possible? We've never seen anything like it. These must be just legends. But the thing is, so many of these different stories describe it in the same way. So how could it just be a legend?
Right. And even with this new research, they're finding parts of the earth that are up in the mountains, down in the river. So something happened.
How did it happen?
Right. Yeah. It's pretty
amazing.
It'd
be interesting to hear the descent of some of those people and how they actually disproved Noah's existence or the flood's existence.
Well, of the comments that I read, it was kind of the typical name calling, you know, like, yeah. How could you believe that?
Well, that's the thing. You have to resort to that because there's really no way to actually disprove it either.
The more they do look into archaeology and the more they do look into these different events, it does prove the Bible out to be true. And Brent Nachtigall talked about that on one of the Trumpet Daily Radio shows this week, mm-hmm. with the Philistines, where they found quite a few of their remains. And so the more they look into these things, yeah, I mean, even if they don't want to talk about Noah and they don't want to talk about the Bible, the numbers kind of put it back in that time period. And they have to admit that, okay, there was some sort of a giant earth-wide, or, well, they'll say region-wide, I guess, mm-hmm. at least in their case, a catastrophe that did happen. And, I mean, they even with the Chinese version of this, which was a little bit of a different, I guess, take on it, people relegated that to just all ridiculous legend and nonsense. And now they find out, oh, wait a second, that was actually correct.
Yeah, and look at the success someone like Dr. Eilat Mazar has had in Israel, not even necessarily being much of a religious person, but just following the Bible's account of where different things are located. And she's uncovering so much there in Jerusalem.
Yeah, there's a lot of really good write-ups about that and some videos at thetrumpet.com where you can see more about that archaeology. It's fun. It's fun to discover those types of things. We all, I think we all like the Indiana Jones type action-adventure movies, but a lot of times archaeology is interesting because it's the real archaeology is not that probably day-to-day exciting, but what it is proving and what it is showing is a lot more exciting than, you know, well, whatever they looked for in those movies. Statues and such.
Yeah, because it's real and it does prove a belief system true, even because the Bible has all of those accounts right there.
Yeah, really interesting. So you can read the rest of that if you'd like to at Washington Post. They go into more of the science of how they discovered all of this, and so a pretty interesting write up there. Here's one last one. This is from howstuffworks.com. We talk a fair bit about, and have heard a lot recently about, physical inactivity, how that's hurting people. Sitting around all day is not a good thing. They say there's a high cost, a monetary cost to it. They're looking at healthcare costs, and they're also looking at lack of productivity. Those are kind of the two main things they're looking at. They say physical inactivity-related losses turned out to be massive, no pun intended. The researchers, I think, the researchers conservatively estimated that $53.8 billion in worldwide healthcare system costs in 2013. And so that's an amazing amount of money that's being spent in the healthcare system to deal with diseases that link back directly to inactivity.
That's incredible. Yeah. And there just are so many devices. We keep talking about how there are just every type of screen that would make you want to just go home, sit on the couch after staring at a computer 8 or 9 hours during your workday.
Yeah, it's getting tougher and tougher to be active. Whereas in years past, people were more active because that was the necessary lifestyle. Mm-hmm. You walk somewhere or, you know, or have more activity. They say physical inactivity-related deaths cost a further $13.7 billion in productivity losses. I guess if you're dead, you can't be that productive.
Yeah, that's true.
The physical inactivity was responsible for a daily tally of 13.4 million. That's a lot of productive years gone for good. Taking the two figures together, the worldwide annual cost of physical inactivity is $67.5 billion. The U.S. alone is responsible for 40% of that number.
Wow. Yeah, it's just the classic case of treating the effect and not the cause. You know, I feel sluggish today, let me take these pills, instead of I feel sluggish today, let me take a nap or go for a run and maybe offset those in a more healthy way.
Yeah, I think it'd be interesting to look at some of the research, and I think they do some studies in relation to how busy people are versus how productive they are. And I didn't look those up, but I just thought of that when you were mentioning, when you were talking about that. We're busier than ever in some ways, and potentially less productive than ever.
Mm-hmm.
And so at least less physically active, that's for sure.
Yeah, and the busier we are, it just becomes easier to say, well, there's no time to exercise, when in reality, when you exercise, you feel better and you're more efficient in the things that you're busy with.
And I always think it's interesting. They have the new wave of technology to help people be active, Fitbit, those types of things. And they're pretty neat, actually. But I was trying to think of like somebody that worked years ago that did physical work all day. And if you told them, hey, put this device on, you know, and they say, well, why? Well, we want to know how many steps you walked today. And they probably think, I don't want to know how many steps I walked today.
I walked 10 miles today.
it was plenty. Yeah, I'm ready to just sit down and relax when I get home. I don't need to count it up, you know.
Exactly.
So it's just different lifestyles. And there is a effect from it. And it's not a good one in a lot of cases. Some of the trends and the headlines going on. The Key of David program, make sure you listen for that this weekend. One of the programs is on what is the true gospel, a very important topic. There's a lot that is mentioned about the gospel, but that's pretty ambiguous. So you need to make sure you understand what the true gospel is, and that's talked about in this Key of David program. And, of course, there's a lot of good literature offered for free on the program and on thetrumpet.com that helps explain that to you. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show today with your host Stephen Fleury from Edstone, England. He gave a little update from the Philadelphia youth camp that they're having over there. And they're not inactive. They're moving around, playing sports.
Mm-hmm.
He said they were playing American football today, earlier today.
Nice.
And so he said it was kind of funny to see those that are more familiar with European football, which would be soccer, playing American football. It's always, depending on where you grew up and what sports you played, for those of us that played sports that dealt more with hands and throwing and catching, it's hard to play soccer and not want to grab the ball with your hands. And mm-hmm. then the reverse is true for them. They just want to kick everything.
Probably catch a pass and then kick it down the field. And they're like, no, what are you doing?
Exactly.
You ruined it.
it's just a different, I guess the brain gets wired differently as far as what you want to do when something's thrown your way or comes your way. Catch it or kick it. Two options there. So that was kind of interesting just to hear about some of what's going on there at the camp. They took a field trip actually yesterday to Stratford upon Avon, which isn't far from there, and they learned a lot about Shakespeare. And of course, that's one of the areas that he was in quite a bit. And Stephen Fleury points out how Shakespeare had a masterful command of the English language. And I think for anybody that's seen any of his plays or read any of it, it is quite amazing. It is Old English, so sometimes it takes a while to get used to it, but. But his stories are really amazing. I mean, he's considered, I'm sure, probably the greatest writer of all time, certainly modern time.
Yeah, and a lot of his writings were inspired by the Bible. And I like him a lot just because English is one of my favorite things anyway. And because he commanded it so well and kept the rules and even exceeded the rules of the language like he did, it's something that really I think it's enjoyable to read.
Yeah, and it's interesting to think about a guy like Shakespeare because we all know him as this great writer, and you think of the works that he produced, and yet it's a person mm-hmm. that lived, and like they were able to see yesterday on this field trip, lived in a home, mm-hmm. had parents, did normal things, read a lot. You know, he was one person, but he was able to do a lot, and it was because he had this wonderful command of the English language, and they spent a lot of time in the Bible, reading
right.
the Bible, and it's always interesting to me because. Growing up, occasionally I would hear something in, say, a song or hear a line in a movie or read something in a book and think, wow, that was really pretty poignant. That was pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And then a couple years later, as I read more of the Bible, I realized, oh, they stole that.
Right.
That's from the Bible. That's where that came from.
And that's pretty much the only deep reading that you have today is whenever you find out it's actually originating from a source like that.
Yeah, so it's really an interesting program today talking about Shakespeare and his writings. And then he also brings out how Abraham Lincoln read mostly the Bible and Shakespeare. And so you think, you look at some of the great things a person like Abraham Lincoln did, his great speeches, dealing with an extremely difficult time during the Civil War. And his mind was full of the best as far as literature, logic, all of those types of things. He had a deep understanding that came from reading the Bible and reading Shakespeare, which Shakespeare was based a lot on the Bible, mm-hmm. of course. And he was able to handle those really difficult times. But, you know, our brains are so fascinating. They're kind of machines in a way. And like they say, you know, you're going to get out of it what you put into it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I know this is a ridiculous comment that's about to happen here, but if Lincoln was spending all of his days watching YouTube, I don't think he would have handled the Civil War as well as he did with, you know, the time that he spent putting good things into his mind.
Exactly. He wouldn't have had the right ideals. He wouldn't have understood even why he believes what he believes. And you see that all the time today. If you ask a Bernie Sanders supporter about socialism, they don't even know what it is, for example. And also, you see just the kind of moral courage that he had, where if he was spending all his time on YouTube, he would be quaking at the thought of trying to lead a nation through a civil war.
Right. And for the listeners that are like, hey, there was no YouTube, it's just a example.
Yes, but he also, you can imagine him not being on YouTube if he was alive today.
Yeah. Yeah, and not to knock YouTube too much. They do have some good stuff. We've got the Trumpet Daily on YouTube and the Key of David as well. But there's a lot of other stuff as
Maybe he would have watched those things.
Probably would have.
That's my ambitious hope.
And avoided the dancing cats, though those are interesting too. So make sure you listen for the Trumpet Daily radio show with your host, Stephen Fleury, today and throughout the weekend. And that's always live Monday through Friday at 7 a.m. And you can catch the replays or download the podcast at kpcg.fm. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, talk about this interesting write-up in The Atlantic. The author says, what if high school were more like kindergarten? We'll talk about that coming up next. Trumpet Radio Live 101.3 KPCG online at kpcg.fm.
Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG is produced by the Philadelphia Church of God. The Philadelphia Church of God offers a library of free educational literature, including Raising the Ruins. Raising the Ruins records the history of the Philadelphia Church of God and its legal battle over the teachings of Herbert Armstrong. The book documents the actions of Herbert Armstrong's successors using original sources. More information is available at raisingtheruins.com.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live on 101.3 KPCG. Thanks for joining us online, too, kpcg.fm and the live link at thetrumpet.com. Well, you can follow us on Twitter if you'd like to do that, at kpcgfm. And you can email us questions or comments or concerns to comments at kpcg.fm. Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon with you here today. This is a time of year where a lot of people travel. And sometimes when you're traveling, you take out your shirt out of your suitcase and it's wrinkly.
Unless you're J.R. Smith.
He doesn't wear a shirt.
He wouldn't have a shirt to take out of his suitcase.
Wouldn't have a problem. I've got this little write-up here. Here's six quick tips to get your shirt taken care of without an iron. They say first thing you do is if you're in a hotel, you turn the shower on, close the bathroom door, and you put towels down to block the under the door so you can get the steam going in the room. I think everyone knows where we're going with this. You hang your garment on the outside of the shower. You don't want to get it wet. Hang it on the outside of the curtain. Make sure the water is good and warm so it produces a lot of steam. You give it a good 3 to 5 minutes, and then you turn the water off, give it another couple of minutes for the steam, and you're done.
I love it.
You ever done that?
No, but I thought I saw my dad do something like that when I was in a hotel with him one time. I didn't ask what he was doing. I guess I wasn't that curious about it, but I guess now I know what it is.
It's a handy way if you've got a few minutes and you don't have an iron and you want to get that shirt taken care of. No matter how well you pack them, you pull them out of there and they're wrinkled.
They're a wrinkled mess. Yeah. So if you don't have an iron, some hotels don't have an iron. I think a lot of them do, but a lot of them don't.
Yep, and sometimes the iron's a little scary, too, because I've had it where it doesn't quite work the way you
All the water
hoping.
Comes out of the bottom every time I try to use an iron. I'm so glad I have a wife now who can do that for me.
She's an expert now.
I'm just the worst ironer there ever was.
You will not be going to the Olympics as an ironer.
No.
You will not be an Iron Man.
Yeah, exactly.
This interesting write-up here from The Atlantic that you've got, Grant. The title is a question. What if high school were more like kindergarten? The author's got a way he'd like to see education be a little different, I guess.
Right. This person started out by saying, I can't actually tell if it was a male or a female. Ashley today is a...
Could go either way.
It's a unisex name. Sure. But he or she started out by saying that, I guess I'll just say he for the sake of this, that he has a strange-looking Yoda bust on his desk. And it came from a high school art class where he was assigned a project of making a human face bust, not a Yoda bust, a human face. And he accidentally was stretching the ears and stretched them too far into a point at the top.
Yeah.
And then thought that was funny and turned the project into making a Yoda instead.
Got to go with the flow sometimes.
Right. But the problem was the teacher wasn't too pleased and failed him for not following the rules of the class. And so he just goes on to make this point that sometimes creativity is stifled just because we're piling up papers and handing out tests, handing out paper assignments, and the students are just taking as many advanced classes as they can because they think that's what the colleges want for their acceptance process. Actual creativity is sort of being stifled.
Yeah, it's. I think we've all had a class like that where something happened. I had an art class where we were in grade school and we had to draw a lion and then color it. And it was one of those days where it just came together for me. I thought, well, that actually looks kind of like a lion. I colored it and I colored it yellow. And I took it up to the art teacher and I was really excited. And she said, that's terrible. She said, lions are brown. They're not yellow. Oh. So I had to go back and recolor it and it just messed the whole thing up. And then I've always thought about that. Every time I watch a show where there's a lion, I'm like, heck, he's kind of yellow.
It is.
There's a yellowishness.
The Lion King. The lions are yellow. I mean, what does she expect?
I think this was pre-Lion King. I couldn't bring that out. She did stifle my creative juices that day for sure.
Yeah, and there's some things about this article I don't necessarily agree with because you talked about sometimes how you should break the rules. I don't think you should ever break a teacher's rules necessarily. Yeah. I would never encourage that. But at the same time, are we actually learning in class instead of being educated, instead of having that proverbial funnel on top of our heads and having the knowledge dumped in?
Well, and that's a really good point, especially if you look at the colleges today, and really you could back it up into high school and so forth, where you have a lot of social change. And that's being pushed quite extensively at young people. And it's being presented like this is the way it is. You accept this or else. And you're not seeing a discussion where there's another side that's brought into it. And quite frankly, something should never be discussed.
Mm-hmm.
But even if they're going to, you'd at least think they would say, well, let's have an environment here where we can put both sides of this up and kind of see which one works.
Right. Have a debate or present a scenario, a real life scenario, where you respond to the situation. For example, in one high school this person was talking about, they actually set up a mock plane crash outside the school, and the different types of students would do their part with that situation. So the students specializing in media would report on the crash. The science students would take forensic samples. And isn't that a fun day at school when occasionally at least you have some sort of activity like that?
Yeah, it's interesting because there is always this sort of, I guess, thought that the educational system should change in some way. And I think you get extremes. You get the extreme on one side that says, no, everything must be cookie cutter. But then sometimes you get the extreme where it's like there are no rules.
Right.
And really, in that middle, it's probably your best spot where, yes, there is definite, like we were talking about literature, there is definite literature that you look at and say, this is good literature.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone should read this. And then, but there should be, you know, some freedom to discuss it, to write about it, that type of thing. But it just seems like we're in an age of extremes where people are jumping to one side or the other and usually jumping to the side of no rules or anti-establishment rules, where, right, like, say, with colleges,
exactly,
they want to flip everything on its head, but that's the rule now. You have to be that way.
And you just have to accept it, basically. Where are the debates anymore? At least that used to be a common part of colleges. If you believed one side, you could present your argument, and if you believe the other side, you could present it as well, and people could form their opinions based on maybe the debate that was had in class. Now it's just, you had better believe this side, or you're a bigot, or whatever is their favorite word now. So debate, logical discussion, being taught how to think and not just funneling book knowledge into your head so that you can pass a test, that's kind of lacking now. And it's proven by what you were saying the other day with so many of these businesses disregarding grades now, basically.
Well, saying, yeah, a lot of them, we talked about that, I think it was yesterday, because Hillary Clinton wants the free colleges for everybody. Mm-hmm. But there's a real disparity between the people that are running the colleges. 96% said, we're doing a great job. And I think 11% of the businesses said, you're giving us worthwhile employees.
Yeah.
They weren't really happy with,
exactly,
with the product they were getting.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is interesting. I think it does highlight that the system is broken to some extent.
Yeah, that's exactly right. This writer talked about how prominent companies like Google don't even take into account GPA or the level of a degree anymore, because there's no correlation between that and actually excelling in the company. That doesn't give you an excuse to just not pay attention in school and to get, you know, straight C's, be middle of the pack all the time. But really, are these classes where you're just funneling in knowledge preparing you for the real world afterward?
Right, and that's probably what they should look at more. Are we teaching somebody to think constructively, creatively, and are we developing any type of character in the people? Because, mm-hmm, I mean, you could have somebody that really knows their stuff, but they don't feel like showing up to work.
Exactly.
They're of no value.
That's something you can't really gauge based on a test score. If someone is lazy and doesn't want to go to work, who cares what the test score was?
Yeah.
Exactly. But this article, it talks about kind of maybe a little bit too much creativity, saying that maybe there shouldn't even be any core subjects.
Mm.
There does have to be a discipline. I mean, everyone needs to know history. Everyone needs to know how English works so they can communicate the right way. I would argue everyone needs to have mathematics, science. Those are some of the core things that really do benefit you your whole life, even if you don't go on to specify in one of those fields or specialize. But at the same time, you should have some freedom for some of these other classes to be able to pick electives that really do stimulate your mind and get you interested, get you excited about your education, instead of always just reading a book and accepting it as a fact, no matter what logic would tell you to believe.
Yeah, you even see this sort of argument, I guess, come up in the world of sports, particularly around draft time when they're drafting new players into whatever the league is, let's say the NBA. And they're looking at, well, does this person fit into this kind of position? We need this sort of cookie-cutter position. But you get guys that come in that don't fit any position necessarily, but they just play really well. So you've got this argument between stats or the advanced stats that they want to, mm-hmm, look at, and then just the old-fashioned eye test, like, that guy plays really hard. Good things happen when he's out there.
Right.
So this kind of argument permeates a lot of levels of society. You know, is there this exact cookie cutter that everybody has to fit into, or is there a way for people to have basic important knowledge, but then kind of take it in different directions based upon their skills?
Yeah, that's a really, really good point. I also read another article recently about how there's a war on stupid people now. I think that was also in the Atlantic, and I wouldn't be so blunt as to call people without a college degree stupid.
Oh, wow.
But at the same time, so many companies, even though there are exceptions, are looking for a certain degree, a certain piece of paper, and they're starting to find out now that that is not really as important as they once thought. There are a lot of different people who maybe only graduated from high school or even didn't go that far, who have the right personality for a certain public relations type job, Maybe they have typing skills and could be a secretary without having to graduate college for whatever reason. There are a lot of different openings for people, and education should sort of reflect that instead of trying to push you to get a 4.0 GPA and take all these advanced classes.
Yeah, it's becoming, I mean, it's a business at some point, especially mm-hmm. once you get up into the colleges. So that's an ongoing thing because
right.
people are really saddled with student debt and they're trying to figure out ways to become educated, become valuable employees, but not be saddled with a debt that you're never going to pay off.
Yeah, I mean, what is really the point of graduating 4 years from a prestigious university if you have hundreds of thousands in debt that only compounds with interest and it's going to take you, you know, 10 or 20 years, even with a really good paying job, just to get out of debt?
And the thing is, probably the reality is a lot of the degrees are not the degrees that are going to get you right into that job. I mean, there are some real hard sciences or people that are going into particular things where they can earn money right away, but there's a lot of degrees where you're not going to earn that money back.
Right, and they've seen even recently that a lot of graduates, they graduate and think they know everything already, especially in this generation of millennials, of which I am a part. And
case in point.
Exactly. And they basically just graduate and feel entitled to the best paying job, and they won't take an entry level position. So is the education really benefiting you if all it is to just boost your ego and make you think that you have all of these facts in your head, so obviously you're qualified for the best job right away?
Yeah, you still have to work your way up in a lot of cases. Pretty interesting write-up. Again, there's some points that are a little bit we wouldn't agree with, I think, but some interesting points as well. It's in The Atlantic. What if high school were more like kindergarten? More people would go, I guess.
Yeah, teachers inject some random creative fun projects into your class. I think that's something you can take from it.
Cookie break, nap time?
Exactly. And then you can still have a structured curriculum while giving students a reason to be interested and excited to go to school every day.
You know, I think the truth is if you asked a lot of people, they'd probably say kindergarten was one of their favorite years.
Everyone says that. I mean, people are freely admitting that now. I hear it all the time from a lot of friends.
That's interesting. Interesting write-up. That's education and intelligence is always an interesting debate. Before we close today, a couple of history facts here about the Olympics that you might find interesting. As far as the Summer Olympics goes, did you know figure skating was initially part of the Summer Olympics? As before they had the Winter Olympics in 1924, they had figure skating events for the programs in 1908 and 1920 Summer Olympics. And ice hockey also made its Olympic debut at the 1920 Summer Games.
That's one of the best. I always want to watch the hockey Olympics.
They should have moved that one to Antarctica.
Yeah.
Had that one up there. Olympic champions last received solid gold medals in 1912. Mm. That's when you really wanted them.
Oh, yeah.
Back in 1912. Now, you still want them, but they're not worth as much. The Summer Games used to span months, starting in the spring and ending in the fall. So that's quite a long time to be competing in those games, but they shortened them up. The first Olympian to fail a drug test was busted for drinking beer.
Oh, come on.
That's not performance enhancing. That's performance dehancing.
Exactly. That's
not even a word, I don't think.
That is strange.
It was it debuted in 1968, drug testing, and the Swedish pentathlete Hans Gunnar Luftenwall, he was first to test positive for a banned substance. He had two beers. He said he drank them to calm his nerves before the pistol shoot. So I guess he was drinking right before they started.
Maybe that would help. Maybe he was drinking it out there on the track.
He wasn't hiding everybody. He wasn't hiding it at all. And so anyway, he was not allowed to, participate.
Wow.
The 1936, this one's really interesting. The 1936 basketball final was a literal quagmire. When basketball officially debuted at the 36 Berlin Olympics, games were played on outdoor tennis courts made of clay and sand. During the gold medal game between the U.S. and Canada, a second-half deluge turned the court into a muddy mess that would have stymied even the dream team. With dribbling in the mire an impossible task, the waterlogged Americans spent most of the half simply playing catch with the slippery ball. Final score, U.S. 19, Canada 8.
Far below the scores in the hundreds that we expect today.
I would have Excuse me, that one choked me up there. Reminiscing. I was going to say that I would have been pretty good at that, actually, because growing up in Wisconsin, I played on gravel at my house, and the snow would come and it would get wet, so I'd be playing out in the mud too, so I'd be ready for this.
Yeah, that's quite an advantage. You probably could have boosted their score.
I had to wear gloves. I don't know if that was legal, but I've been there. For nearly 40 years, artists also competed for gold medals. I found this really interesting. It used to be more of a cultural event, not just sports. Before the modern Olympic Games, there was art involved. Beginning with the 1912 Stockholm Games, gold, silver, and bronze medals were awarded in painting, sculpture, architecture, literature, and music. Works entered in the competitions won the first gold medal for literature. And so there was all kinds of different ones. They got rid of them eventually. Obviously, they don't do it anymore because part of it was they said the artists were professionals and needed to be amateurs, even though we have professional athletes.
Exactly. If you want to draw a lot more viewers to the Olympics, add all those things back in. There are tons of people who don't necessarily have any interest in sports.
Yeah, it would be fascinating, wouldn't it, to be watching a sporting competition and then to see like a musical competition playing instruments, or to see like the best of a painting competition. I think that'd be fascinating.
Yeah, the whole Olympic ideal is a pretty honorable one anyway. So to maybe just showcase the entire greatest of the human spirit in every field instead of just athletics.
Yeah, really cool. A gymnast with a wooden leg won 6 medals, including 3 golds in the 1904 Olympics. That was before Blade Runner. You remember him? Of course, he's been pretty infamous since that Olympics a couple of years ago. But in the 1904 St. Louis Games, hometown boy George Iser, who lost his left leg as a youth after it was run over by a train, won gold in the parallel bar, long horse, and rope climbing events. He also won silver in the side horse and all-around competitions and bronze in the horizontal bar. So good for him. That's exciting to see. It is always fascinating when you see the Paralympic Games where people are. There was a story on the news the other night where the volleyball team was practicing here in the Edmond area, and they in most cases are missing legs, and so they just scoot around and the net's low, it's on the ground. But I imagine, I wonder if I could beat them. They probably would beat me.
that's the embarrassing part. But those people are just great examples of not having a victim mentality, because really you can do anything if you set your mind to it.
Yeah, they really exhibit, I think, that ideal Olympic spirit where they're out there to really challenge themselves, and they have a goal and they're going after it, and it gives them hope, and it gives them a real sense of accomplishment, say more so than going for money or something like that. Pretty good examples. America's first female Olympic champion had no idea she was even competing in the Summer Games. While studying art in Paris in 1900, 22-year-old American Margaret Abbott saw an advertisement for a golf tournament, and she decided to enter. After shooting a 47 on the 9-hole course, she won the tournament and took home a porcelain bowl. She didn't even know it, but the tournament she had entered was part of the Paris Games. And she just became the first American woman to win an Olympic event, and she didn't even know she was in it.
Some people are just so charmingly ignorant of their surroundings.
Yeah, that's. I find that incredibly awesome for some reason. How did you win that bowl? Oh, I don't know.
She felt no pressure.
No. Yeah, that's really interesting. The equestrian events at the 1956 Melbourne Games were held on the other side of the world. We talked about that one because of they weren't allowed to bring the livestock in, so that's pretty interesting. When the Americans refused to dip their flag to King Edward VII in 1908, it started a tradition. They were upset that the U.S. flag was missing from those fluttering above the Olympic Stadium during the opening ceremonies of the 1908 London Games. And so the American flag bearer, Ralph Rose, refused to follow protocol and dip the stars and stripes as he passed the royal box. So he was upset. It's interesting because sometimes in the Olympics, besides just the sports and some of the other excitement, you get some political statements.
Yeah, that occur. That's right. I think, wasn't there an Olympics in Russia where a lot of the national teams boycotted? I think a lot of the American teams did. I don't know if it ever went through, but I mean, that would really...
Yeah,
hurt the home country.
That has happened. Where I mean, it's hard to go square off in athletics when you're at war or something's going on. So pretty interesting. It'll be a lot of fun to see what happens at the Olympics. Hopefully, it's safe. Mm-hmm. A lot going on in the world, but always fun to watch those. And that starts this weekend. So hopefully, we got you somewhat interested in in the Olympics. If nothing else, some interesting facts about some of the past ones. Make sure you listen for the Key of David program and the Trumpet Daily Radio Show and the Trumpet Hour Week in Review program. That'll do it for us on Trumpet Radio Live. Myself, Dwight Falk, and Grant Turgeon. Have a great rest of your day and weekend, and we'll see you back here on Monday.